As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Today's episode of The Audible is brought to you by Trader Joe's, where the crew is on your team. Grab your shopping cart, make a quick snap, and move out of the pocket. Run an option to the demo station. Make an end around to the snacks, then find an eligible receiver to take you to the end zone. Learn more at TraderJoe's.com and at Trader Joe's on Instagram.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible. I am Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by Stuart Mandel. We are officially in the off-season, Stu. We're a week out of the national title game. Both of us are back in our comfortable habitats in California, albeit different parts of the state. I think we should start on a kind of a somber note, since we had some sad news in the world of sports, especially that hits close to home in college football. A true icon passed away over the weekend, the great Keith Jackson. Let me ask you, I mean, is there any more iconic figure for you when it comes to broadcasting than Keith Jackson?
No, absolutely not. But in particular, how closely intertwined he was with college football. You know, when I was reading the various stories, it was actually pretty amazing to read that he called everything from baseball playoffs to Monday Night Football, all these things, some of them which I'm sure I heard at the time. But to me, he was always the voice of college football, more so than I think, you know, I mean, there are a lot of great people calling college football today, but for a younger person, it would be hard to describe how one person could stand out so far above the others, how when Keith Jackson was calling a game, that meant it was the big game.
Yeah, I thought on your own site, John Walters, our friend, your media critic for The Athletic, for The All-American, did a really good job. And I don't know if the right term is colloquialism, but because college football had such a provincial aspect to it, and I thought Keith Jackson, you know, that role of being like kind of tour guide from wherever you seem to be tuning in, from your own remote outpost to wherever that outpost was, I thought hit close to home in a way more than, let's say, you know, I mean, I think we both grew up on Brent Musburger's, you know, NFL Today. You're looking live, and it could be, you know, Fulton County Stadium or somewhere, you know, in Atlanta or somewhere in Wisconsin. But with college towns, it's a lot different because a lot of them are smaller. And I thought there's just a very regional aspect of the sport. And he really sold it. I mean, just because I think it felt very authentic.
Yeah, there was a clip I tweeted out from the intro that they did to the Ohio State-Miami BCS title game that he narrates. And it includes a phrase that he used to say every time he did an Ohio State game. He would talk about the horseshoe, and he referred to it as down on the Olentangy River. Like, just a little phrase like that is just, it makes it unique. It makes you feel like, you said, like, if you're somebody from any other part of the country that's never been to Ohio State, may never go to Ohio State, you do know that the stadium is down on a river, on the Olentangy.
Saying this with respect, do you think he is, whether subconsciously or consciously, imitated by many of the people who are calling football, especially now?
I don't think so. I feel like that may have been the case in a previous generation, that there were a lot of announcers that kind of sort of sounded like Keith Jackson. I don't think you can replicate it. It's where he was from. It's almost from another. I mean, I really feel like his broadcasting style is from another era. We talked about this actually when Brent Musburger retired. You just don't hear a lot of announcers like that today. There are a lot of announcers who say they're very polished. There are not a lot of announcers whose voice alone can carry a broadcast.
No, I think, and you know, one of those things where it's like, okay, it sounds like a big event when they're there. I think that is that's just a rare quality some guys have. You know, it's not to say that they're as good as Keith Jackson, and there's a couple of people I'm thinking of, you know, who we're friends with, and I don't know if it's fair to even throw them in this discussion, you know, just because I don't want people to think we're saying they're you know, as good as Keith Jackson was or on that level at this point. But they're, you know, there is a rare quality if you can make a game sound big. I really can't say I knew Keith Jackson. I didn't have, you know, any interaction with him other than this one. It was probably, I don't know if it was 10 years ago now. It's probably about 8 years ago. It was when the Pac-12 network was launching, and they were doing these like kind of retrospectives, and they were lining up media people. You know, they would have you booked for a studio for like an hour, and you'd come in and they would ask you, you know, about 20 things or games. And so I go out to somewhere in the valley in Southern California, and I'm there waiting. And then all of a sudden, you know, as we're about to start taping, Keith Jackson kind of rolls in, and I was like, whoa, you know, because we're in like a hotel. It's just like it was just kind of a very nondescript kind of setting. And he was like, oh, I'm early. And I was like, wow, that's Keith Jackson. And I'm thinking, you know what, why don't you go in front of me? You know, A, I felt weird making Keith Jackson wait. And B, I thought it would be a lot more interesting to hear his comments than him hear mine. When in truth, a lot of the games I was going to be talking about, short of like the Matt Leinart USC days, sometimes they schedule you for stuff. I honestly don't remember. You know, I saw highlights of O.J. Simpson at USC or some of those things. But most of the stuff, Keith Jackson's exactly who you want to hear from, whereas, you know, a guy in his 40s in that age, you know, is not who you want to hear from. So that was a cool experience for me just to kind of to listen to him tell those stories and just kind of really just kind of swing from his heels and listen to all that stuff. And he seemed just as sharp and as lucid at that point as he did when he was calling games.
Bruce, let's take a moment from the podcast to introduce a new sponsor, and that is ZipRecruiter.
Well, Stu, like anything as important as we all know, since a big chunk of our fan base are big fans of recruiting, and we know how critical that is, the lifeblood for any college football program, as evidenced by our latest national title team. Obviously, Nick Saban knows a lot about recruiting because we saw a true freshman all over the field making plays last Monday night. So let's get into a little bit about what ZipRecruiter can do for our listeners.
Indeed, and a fresh new year has begun, and if you're setting new goals for your business, it's extremely difficult to reach them without the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you go about finding them.
In need of great talent for your business, but short on time, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools. You just need smarter tools.
Well, what ZipRecruiter does is they post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply.
They can even review every application to identify the top candidates so you never miss a great match. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them.
Well, no wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TASB, as in the audible Stu and Bruce. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TASB Go try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/TASB. So I never had any personal interactions with him, but I worked very briefly at ABC when I graduated from college, as you know. It was the 1998 football season, and that was the year that he originally retired. So that whole season was a tribute to Keith Jackson, and it was a really big deal, obviously, if you were working on the college football side of ABC. He then ended up deciding to stay on, but mostly his biggest complaint, I think, at that point was the travel. So they agreed to have him stay on, but no longer be the number one game, no matter where it was. He mostly stayed to the West Coast. And then I remember kind of what you're just describing. I remember walking through the media hotel at the Rose Bowl in 2005. And, you know, every year at the national championship game, ESPN still does this. They have the people who are calling the game do either a press conference or media. You know, the reporters want to interview them. And he was coming. He was, like, carrying his briefcase. He was coming over to do that. And I passed by him. And little did we know at the time that that would end up being his last game, the Vince Young Rose Bowl. He got on himself pretty hard because he felt like he was making a lot of mistakes toward the end of his career. And I do remember at the time, like, now it seems really cool that he was the voice of that great game. But at the time, people complained that the person calling them, you know, the national championship game was getting some names wrong and whatnot. But I don't know. I went down a pretty deep YouTube rabbit hole on Saturday morning watching some old highlights that he called. For me personally, he'll always be the voice of the Northwestern Rose Bowl. And obviously I was there. I didn't hear it in real time, but I watched it many times after that. And nobody, I mean, I don't know about you, but that's what I associated with him most. He always called the Rose Bowl.
Well, yeah, and I think the whole, you know, the granddaddy of them all and everything, there was a gravitas to it. And I think that that's part of the tradition. When everyone gets kind of a little frustrated with college football, people for maybe beholden to the tradition, I think part of what they see is Keith Jackson's, you know, fingerprints on it to some degree. And I think that's where the reverence for it is.
I watched the game broadcast just the other day of the Alabama-Georgia game. And there's nothing, I want to be clear, there's nothing wrong with Chris Fowler's call of it or Kirk Herbstreit or anybody involved with it. It was a perfectly well done broadcast. But there's nothing about either that event or the way it's presented that you would use the word tradition. I mean, it's very much it very much feels like something that started 4 years ago, which it did. Every game Keith did, probably at the time at least, felt like you were kind of tapping into a longstanding tradition, whether it was the campus that it was at or the various traditions at that school. His voice was just so closely tied to it.
Yeah, and look, I think that, like you said, it's kind of unfair to compare anyone to him just because he was on a different level. You know, we're talking about a guy who did it for you know, generations and generations, as opposed to, you know, we're talking about contemporaries here who are still, you know, in the business of doing it. So
indeed,
and I just think that, you know, it's a different time in era now. I think it's hard to attain the level he was at. I mean, who knows what it'd be like if, you know, you have some great broadcasting career happening in the age of social media where everybody picks apart every little thing. You know, I think it's rare to see somebody who's, you know, like across the board, you see a broadcaster and they're trending, and you know, and it's for a good thing.
Well, he also,
never happens.
I mean, he started college football in 1966. So for a long period there, he was calling college football at a time when he may have been calling the only game that was on, period. You know, there would be a national game of the week on ABC, and that was it. It's hard to distinguish yourself now when on a given Saturday there are, I don't know what the number is, but there's 130 teams and split that in two, and almost all those games are on television somewhere. So it's just the whole media landscape is much different. But at that time, he was the voice of the sport. I actually saw that news Saturday morning. I know he passed away Friday night. I saw that news Saturday morning, like, when I first went on my phone, which I hadn't done right away, and it just kind of like made me stop in my tracks.
Well, there was also some other pretty big news in college football over the weekend. There was a vacancy, the last FBS head coaching vacancy that
for
was
now.
Open for now. Arizona hired Kevin Sumlin. It was an interesting search. What do you make of the hire?
I think it's a very good hire because, I mean, for one thing, that's who I would have hired if I was Arizona State. Certainly not Herm Edwards. I would have hired Sumlin. And and now he's at the rival school. Chantel Jennings, our covers Pac-12 for the All-American, wrote about Khalil Tate and how much he might benefit from Sumlin because, listen, there's no question things went south in College Station, and they had every right to fire him. He had gotten stale. They were going 8-4 every year. But, I mean, this is still the guy who coached the quarterback who just threw the miracle touchdown pass in the NFL playoffs, Case Keenum, who coached Johnny Manziel. He's bringing Noel Mazzoni with him, who coached Brett Hundley. I feel like Khalil Tate, who voiced an opinion on Twitter that he was not going to be very fond of the hire if they hired Kenny Amatalolo to run the triple option, is going to be thrilled with this hire.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think it would be a really good fit. By the way, I had after the news comes out that he is getting the job, that someone's getting the job, and as you said, Khalil Tate was on social media, and a lot of his teammates on Arizona were also, you know, not looking, did not want Kenny Amatalolo there. You know, the reaction was just kind of I think it at that point, because from my reporting that really Niematalolo and Sumlin were the two finalists, and we had reported that Niematalolo had pulled out his name out of consideration. But I think at that point he had known that it was kind of going to be an uphill battle, even if he got the job when he walks into that situation. You know, it was just not a good situation. So I had reported, I guess it was Sunday, that someone was getting the job. I got a text from a football coach out here. He said, "Does Khalil know he was running the triple from the gun?" Basically saying, like, he may hate the triple option, but that's basically what he's doing from the shotgun. And I said, he probably doesn't, but I'm guessing that he saw that, you know, Navy only throws it like 4 or 5 times a game, and that was probably the bigger issue.
I get the question, you know, every now and then in the mailbag, why don't more teams run the triple option? You know, why doesn't...
It's hard to recruit to.
Yeah, pre-Scott Frost, people out, why doesn't Nebraska just go back to running the triple option? Why is Georgia Tech the only one? Well, that's exactly why. Kids, it has such a negative stigma as being associated entirely with the service academies, and you don't pass. But he's right. The coach you talked to is right. A spread option, Rich Rodriguez type offense is based on the same exact principles as the triple option, and I also think he would adjust it. I don't think he would go to a place like Arizona and say we're going to pass the ball 7 times a game. So that's a little unfair. That if that is the reason he didn't get the job, that's a little unfair.
Yeah, I mean, in someone's case, I think the challenges are, and we had our TV crew had Arizona in the bowl game. He walks into a situation where I think he has a chance to win 8 games right away, maybe even more than that. As you mentioned, Khalil Tate, he's probably going to be the best player in the Pac-12. Now, he was spectacular at times last year. He's also, by, you know, people inside the program's own admission, he's not a good practice player. He's got to get way better on that side of it in his preparation, which I think is going to be one of their bigger challenges. But they have a ton of freshmen and sophomores in that program who are pretty good, but they've got to get bigger and more physical. And I'll say this, and I feel pretty comfortable saying this, Kevin Sumlin will be the best recruiter they've ever had working at Arizona. And this is a program that's never been to a Rose Bowl, you know, and they've had some really good players through the years there. But, you know, when I did a couple of their games, and you just see it eyeballing them on the sideline, I mean, they don't look like any other Pac-12 team physically. I mean, they're a smaller team, especially on defense. Now, the last year, you know, 2 years ago, Rich Rod changed his defensive staff, brought in Marcel Yates, and shook up and brought in some other recruiters on that side of the ball to address that. And I think, you know, you started to see it paying off a little bit. But that's where I think someone's really got his work cut out for him, is to get this team to be a lot more bigger and a lot more physical, because that's where they're quite honestly lacking.
All right, so let's just play devil's advocate for here for a second. If you're somebody who is going to pan this hire, you might say, well, he couldn't go better than 8-4 without Johnny Manziel at SEC school with all the resources in the world. Why do you think he'll do well at a school that's frankly one of the least supported football wise in its new in its current conference?
Well, I would flip it and say, who do you look at in the Pac-12 South that is anything close to Alabama talent wise, or LSU talent wise, or even what Ole Miss was? I mean, I see in the Pac-12 right now a lot of Arkansas's. I mean, quite honestly, you have, when he's taken over, you have USC that is going to be now moving on from Sam Darnold. I mean, this is probably about as vulnerable as USC's been. You have UCLA flipping the reset button. I think Chip Kelly will do well there, but I mean, they just, you know, barely made a bowl game. The aforementioned Herm Edwards hire that I think both of us think is going to be a disaster. I think Utah is still going to be Utah, and that's really strong and a solid program. And you have Colorado that's been, you know, has had one good year in the last, I don't know, 10. So it's not, he's not in the SEC West anymore.
That's my thinking. I think that A&M, you're seeing this now with the amount of money they're going to pay Jimbo Fisher, has very, very high expectations, extraordinary expectations, and ones that are very hard to meet in a division with, certainly with Alabama, but also with LSU and Auburn and others. Arizona's expectations are going to be much more modest. I mean, frankly, if Rich Rod could have built on the season where they went to the Pac-12 title game and got crushed by Mariota, if they had, you know, not fallen right back down, he might have curried more favor there. Obviously, the scandal probably would have done him in regardless. So, you know, if let's put it this way, Kevin Sumlin got fired for going 8-4 every year at A&M. If he went 8-4 every year at Arizona with like an occasional spike to 9 or 10, I think he'd be doing just fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think it's perception here. Now, I mean, what is his record compared to Dan Mullen's, right? I mean, Dan Mullen, I think, averaged 8 wins for the last 5 years. He gets the Florida job. Kevin Sumlin gets fired at Texas A&M.
He did have that one great year where they went to number one. I feel like you need one of those.
But they didn't finish.
No, but you need one of those where you. Yeah, that was about as much excitement as there's ever been for Mississippi State football.
I mean, Sumlin did have, it was the only top five finish in the last 50 plus years at A&M. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to lead them to their first Rose Bowl, but let's go to that. So, they've never gone to a Rose Bowl. Give me the percent chance that in 5 years, Kevin Sumlin gets Arizona to its first Rose Bowl.
I'm still going to put that. That's still going to be pretty low, I think.
Under 30%?
Yeah, under 30%. Because you've still got David Shaw. You've still got Chris Peterson coming out of the other division. You've got Chip Kelly now in the South. Mm-hmm. Whether Clay Helton makes it long-term or not at USC, that's always going to be, they're always going to be a force to be reckoned with. I think he will have some really good seasons there. I don't know about Rose Bowl.
Okay.
You?
I would put it at 40%.
There, you heard it right there. 40% to the Rose Bowl. Of course, that question is a little complicated because what if it's one of the years that the Rose Bowl is hosting a semi, but they're still in the New Year Six? I don't know.
Look, I think next year they'd have actually a shot to win the Pac-12 South, a decent shot.
They got a lot. That was a very young team with a lot of talent on offense. They were pretty terrible on defense, but they had some freshmen freshmen All-American type players that if they could develop under a new regime, they could be pretty good.
I just don't know who you look at in the Pac-12 South and go, okay, that's a top 10 caliber team right now, top 15. I just don't see it.
Other coaching news. So we had a question in our mailbag, and I'm going to read it because it ties into the news we're about to talk about. From Andy in York, South Carolina. Bruce and Stu, how much longer do you think Nick Saban will coach at Alabama, and do you see this run continuing for as long as he is there? So the news I'm referring to, Brian Daboll, the offensive coordinator who came in from the Patriots, was the offensive coordinator for the national championship this season, is off to the Buffalo Bills. Gone after one season. They've got to hire a new offensive coordinator a year after he hired Daboll, who replaced Sark, who lasted one game after replacing Kiffin, who was there for a few years. I mean, one of the things that really doesn't get talked about with this dynasty is that it has not been a case where the coaching staff remains intact. It's been the exact opposite. I feel like he's always hiring new offensive coordinators. Defensive coordinator was Kirby Smart up until a couple years ago. So how does Saban respond to this? You know, and does that play any role in your thinking? Will this turnover, constant turnover of offensive coordinators, eventually catch up to him?
No, I actually think part of him likes this because I think he knows that you have to constantly shake things up to keep things on edge and reset the dynamic the way it needs to be so people don't get soft and don't get complacent. My hunch is he is going to promote from within and elevate Mike Locksley, who's the co-OC, to the offensive coordinator job, you know, going forward. And Locksley, from what I understand, had a key role, you know, with all the RPOs and some of the different things that Brian Daboll, quite honestly, had to learn from, you know, getting into the college game after spending so much time in the NFL. And I think that adjustment, and we'll see what Saban does to fill the staff around. You know, he's already made a couple moves, but my hunch is that's what he's going to do, is promote Locksley.
Yeah, it's interesting how different the perception of this would have been if this news, I mean, this news comes on the heels of a national title game where he was the offensive coordinator and they brought in the freshman quarterback off the bench and had all these freshmen. When I rewatched the game, I couldn't believe how many plays in the second half. All of the skill players, for the most part, were true freshmen except for Calvin Ridley. So this was kind of a showcase for Alabama's offense. But for the most part, I'm not sure anybody up until that point would have watched Alabama this season and been blown away by the Brian Daboll offense. So this seems like a less – this doesn't seem like a blow the way it felt like given when Kiffin and then Sark both left after Kiffin had indisputably changed that offense.
Yeah, look, I mean, and to piggyback on this, so it's – as we're taping this, it's late Monday night, but Hugh Freeze, the old Ole Miss coach, was in Tuscaloosa, met with Nick Saban on Monday. Now, from my understanding, it's really not directly involved with that OC vacancy, but it wouldn't shock me if he ended up there in some other capacity on the staff. You know, as I kind of tweeted about, one of his old offensive coordinator, Dan Werner, at Ole Miss, actually was on the staff at Alabama for a year. Now, he just left as an analyst to go be the quarterback coach at South Carolina. Saban be interested in hiring Freeze as an analyst in some capacity like that? I could see that.
Oh, when the news came out Saturday about Daboll, or I guess it was Sunday, that was the first thing that popped in my head. We know Hugh Freeze is going to get back in college coaching. I thought it would take a year. He might need a year to let the stigma pass. But if there's any coach that could do it and just not worry about the blowback, it would be Saban. And I can't imagine there's a coach who respects Hugh Freeze's offense more than Nick Saban. I mean, he just tormented with him for 3 years. That they Ole Miss won the first two games, but even the third year, Alabama won, but he gave him a handful.
Yeah, put up 43 points on them. So I could definitely see that, you know, being a fit there. Now, you know, we'll see if Freeze has any other options. I mean, there's some smaller offensive coordinator jobs I could see, you know, maybe he being in the mix for, but you know, if Nick Saban is, as we know, has hired, among others, Lane Kiffin, Steve Sarkisian at times in their career where they, I don't know, where a lot of other guys, I'm not sure, would have been able to hire them.
Yeah, but in this situation, Hugh Freeze ran a program that was going to say convicted. I don't know if that's the right phrase, but that the NCAA found guilty of major recruiting violations and paying players and surely, if you coach at Alabama, you were more aware of that than the NCAA was because you're recruiting against them. So, to me, this is a lot different than overlooking Hugh Freeze's other extramarital issues or Lane Kiffin's controversial ways or whatever. Like, how do you get past that part? You're going to hire somebody onto your staff who ran a program that was breaking NCAA rules.
Well, I think the NCAA didn't come down on Freeze as hard as I think a lot of people expected them to, though. You know, he basically
not on him personally,
right? That's my point. So I don't know. As we said, if anyone would do it, I could see Nick Saban, you know, being, hey, if my compliance people are comfortable with it, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
If he thinks it's going to help him win games.
Hey, here's a little bit of breaking news across the ticker right as we're recording this. Washington grad transfer QB KJ Carter-Samuels tells me, it's from Barton Simmons, that he's heading to UCLA as a grad transfer. Could that be Chip Kelly's quarterback next year?
maybe. Now, I guess it's a three horse race with, Modster, who played pretty well late in the year when Josh Rosen got hurt, and Dorian Thompson-Robinson, who's a pretty hyped incoming freshman from Las Vegas. So, I don't know. I'm sure that a lot of people are going to want to play in this system. So, you know, he hasn't got a chance to play because he lost the battle basically to Jake Browning, I guess it was 3 years ago.
Right.
You know, but he was pretty hyped out of high school.
That's what I recall. And then it was Browning's show. So, that's going to be a really interesting subplot to watch. I think UCLA has a lot more. There's a lot more work to be done there than just the quarterback. But everybody wants to know who's going to be running Chip Kelly's offense. We're going to get to some reader emails here, or listener emails here in a second. But first, real quick, Guy, we're recording this the day of the NFL draft deadline. Not all of the decisions have come in, but most of them have at this point. Anything either that blew you away, either in terms of I can't believe that guy's leaving or I can't believe that guy's staying?
I'm going to go with the latter, and I can't believe everybody is staying at Clemson.
That's mine, too.
You know, looking around, I mean, it's like you already have what should be like a preseason All-American defensive line that's going to be in Clemson, South Carolina. I mean, the one guy who was not a question mark was Dexter Lawrence because he couldn't leave because he was only a second-year sophomore. But everybody else, I was like, oh, those guys are pretty fringe first-round picks, and they're all coming back in addition to like a bunch of five-star kids who are coming in. So good luck moving the ball and trying to complete passes against the Clemson Tigers in 2018. I'm curious as to when we look back on this team, you know, how many of these guys will end up as first round picks who are on this roster on the defensive line. I bet it'll be at least five, and it could be as many as like eight.
I mean, it's insane. You've got, first of all, when I did the way too early top 25 that went up the morning after the game, I think I had Clemson third. And the only reason I didn't have them higher was, what was the biggest strength of that team this year? Defensive line. Oh, they could have. At that point, you thought, well, Christian Wilkins to me was a no-brainer. Of course he's going to turn pro. And then Clelin Ferrell could too, and Austin Bryan could too. None of them turn pro. They're all back. Dexter Lawrence will be a junior.
Deion Kane on the other side of the ball did turn pro.
So did, oh, and you know what? Mitch Hyatt, their offensive lineman, came back. So everybody wants to stay at Clemson. Should we just skip the rest of the season and book the Alabama-Clemson championship game here in Santa Clara next year?
No, I wouldn't get – let's not get too far ahead of ourselves on this.
I know. It is going to be I would say, historic defensive line in terms of if everybody plays to their potential a year from now, you could have the starting four defensive linemen from a team all called in the first round, some of them awfully high. It's insane.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is next year, you know, we had at one point this year was like the year of the running back.
Mm-hmm.
I think this will be the year of the defensive line. And if you think about it, I remember doing this story a couple of years ago, right before signing day, where I talked to a bunch, I don't know, it was like 30 or 40 coaches and said, who would you think would be the biggest impact player of all the freshmen? It was the year Rashawn Gary was like the clear number one in a lot of people's eyes. And I had some different coaches who thought, okay, it's going to be Dexter Lawrence. I had a handful of people thought it was going to be Ed Oliver, who's obviously ended up at Houston. But, I mean, there are some real studs on the D-line who are only going to be like, you know, a lot of them are in that class who are going to be third-year juniors.
Nick Bosa's in that class?
Is also in that class, correct, yeah.
Yeah, so you got those three that you just mentioned will be juniors. You got the Clemson guys. Wait, you mentioned four. Rashawn Gary, Dexter Lawrence, Ed Oliver, and Nick Bosa are all in that class.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, it'll definitely be the year of defensive linemen in college football, to say the least. And if you're an NFL team, that's an area of need, frankly, you might want to wait a year.
Any other things that catch your eye, a guy you're like, wow, I can't believe this kid left, or anything like that?
I mean, the trend to me up until this past week was that everybody was turning pro. There weren't a lot of guys staying. It was mostly guys turning pro.
Under the radar, one that stayed that I think will be a key one into the national championship race,
mm-hmm.
Miles Gaskin. Now, he's not a big running back, but he's very shifty. He's a really good player for Washington. I think Washington if I were picking a playoff team right now on the West Coast, sign me up for the Washington Huskies.
Yeah, and you know, conversely, USC got hit pretty hard by guys turning pro.
Yeah, well, Darnold was the big one. I mean, you know, Darnold, I think that's,
all their, you know, if you were to say who were the four best players on that team last year,
Ronald Jones is definitely, that would be that guy, yeah.
And don't you think the two defensive guys too?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's they were some of their better players, but I think in terms of just the impact, it was like, you know, honestly, where if I'm a USC fan, besides Darnold leaving, I think the biggest blow to them was for them seeing Dylan McCullough, their running back coach, go to the Chiefs. Because I think for a lot of USC people, like, they were like, that's our best assistant coach, or that's the one they seem to like the most. He had he hadn't been there that long, but he was a guy that everybody really kind of was a big believer in. He did really well for Ronald Jones. I think they had seen his work when he was in the Big Ten. You know, so I think for USC fans, they're a little bit reeling at this point because of stuff like that.
All right, let's get to the mailbag. You can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We got nothing but time in the off season to answer your emails. And this is going to be one of those interesting ones where Bruce hasn't seen any of them. So I get to just fire them off at him as if he's not, you know, slow, as if the having a massive cold is not hard enough. And you know, now you got to react on your feet. You ready?
Let's go.
All right. Lucas Branson. Hey, Stu and Bruce. Is Josh Jackson the answer for Virginia Tech to get back to the national championship, or at least to the playoff? He showed really good signs early in the season, throwing for 16 touchdowns in the first seven games, but only four in the last six games with a heavily declining completion percentage. With a highly touted QBs waiting in the wings, such as Hendon Hooker and Elite 11 standout Quincy Patterson, I'm not sure he's got the it. This question started out like so excited about Josh Jackson, and by the end, he's ready to bench him for Quincy Patterson.
I feel bad about answering this question because I spent like a half hour talking to Josh Jackson's uncle in the media hospitality room the other night. So,
you want to say who that is for people who don't know?
Yes, I should. And it's David Jones, who's like kind of the dean of the Penn State beat. I don't know. I mean, I thought he played really well in the games I saw him, and I think Justin Fuente does a really nice job of bringing him along, but I think it's a good thing. I've seen Quincy Patterson. I've not seen the other guy. I mean, Quincy Patterson, by the way, is the most guy who looks like he's 34 years old of anybody probably coming into college. I mean, he's like a muscled up, big, pretty mature, pretty, you know, he's like an intelligent kid.
We did a big feature on him on the All-American leading up to the December signing period.
I didn't realize that. Yeah, he's physically impressive. So we'll see. We'll see if he can push. You know, I think that what's they got to keep doing is developing skill guys around them. You know, for so long, I felt like Virginia Tech had a really good running game. It was almost like interchangeable. There would be always a good running back there, maybe an under the radar guy. I feel like that tailed off a little bit in the last couple of years or so. And I think that needs to come back. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that He's throwing out big goals there, and I don't blame him. But for Virginia Tech to get to that level, it's going to take more than Josh Jackson. I feel like they've been missing. They still have a really good defense. In fact, they could have a really good defensive line next year. But they have been missing the big-time playmakers that you used to see in an earlier era. So, but hey, Fuente is a great offensive coach, and I have a lot of faith in him to get it done. But if you're looking at the ACC, you know, kind of the early look at it next year, obviously, Clemson will be the favorite, but even in the other division, I mean, Miami won that division this year with a very young team. I would think you'd expect them to be right in the mix for next year.
Yeah, I would think Miami will be better next year than they were this year.
Right.
So
doesn't mean Virginia Tech couldn't be a lot better, too, but I don't know.
Yeah, especially when you're playing with a redshirt freshman quarterback, no doubt. Well, he's going to have to continue to take a step, and I think it's in reality, I mean, I think that's kind of what you'd expect from a freshman quarterback. There would be a lot of inconsistency. And, you know, he started out the year on a real strong, you know, his national TV, played well against West Virginia. And I think he had his moments, but I think consistency, it's not a stretch to expect him to be inconsistent.
Brian Smith. Hey, Stu and Bruce, would Auburn have been better off declining an invite to the SEC championship game? They were ranked number two going into the weekend, then lost a rematch to Georgia. The two teams they beat in their last three regular season games ended up playing in the national championship game while they were relegated to the Peach Bowl and handed a humiliating loss to UCF. That's an extreme scenario, of course, but I don't like the idea that making a championship game and losing is worse than not making it at all. you know, that assumes that if they basically flipped roles with Alabama, and I know that that's been brought up, Alabama got a pass, didn't have to play an extra game, still made the playoff, and then won the national title. I mean, Auburn had two losses, so they may have been number two going into that weekend, but as we know, the committee can change that on a dime, and if they hadn't played in the SEC championship, would they have really made it in over a bunch of one-loss teams?
Do you think that it's the two-loss thing, or do you think some of that also would be the Saban-Alabama factor, get the benefit of the doubt?
There's no question Saban and Alabama get the benefit of the doubt on every turn. I mean, you know, people have brought this up to diminish the five national championships. I think that's not fair because it's very, very hard to win the national championship. But two of those, one of them was this year, they didn't win their division. In 2011, they didn't win their division. In 2012, I remember they lost to Manziel and it thought all hope was lost. And then the very next week, the two undefeated teams ahead of them both lost, and then they're right back in the top two. Like, there has been a lot of that in this Alabama run. That being said, you still got to get into the playoff or into the national championship and win the games. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think Auburn would have been given that benefit of the doubt. For one thing, I think it's frankly I had to do a double take to remember that. Oh yeah, they really were ranked number two coming off the Iron Bowl. I think that might have been the committee getting a little caught up in the excitement of it, because at the end of the day, they were that level of a team for about a month. I don't think anybody thought they were a playoff caliber team in September and October.
Fair enough.
All right, this one is definitely up your alley. Bruce and Stu, this is from James B. By the time you're reading this, Ed Orgeron has likely promoted Steve Ensminger to offensive coordinator, and that he has. As you can see with this poll on dandydon.com, that's a old-time LSU fan site, probably dates the beginning of the internet. Nearly two-thirds of LSU fans are not happy with this promotion. Count me among them. I bring this up because LSU's 2018 schedule is a gauntlet. Using Stu's way too early top 25 poll, we play five teams ranked inside the top 15, not to mention three of them as conference road games, among them being Dan Mullen's Florida. Stu, I know you have us ranked as 19th entering next year, and there's obviously reasons to get excited about this 2018 team. However, with an underwhelming hired offensive coordinator and so many starting roles to replace, is it plausible LSU could finish with a very underwhelming record?
It's plausible. I mean, I actually think their team is probably built for 2019. They're probably a year away. But, you know, my guess is they should be better on defense in this coming year than they were in 2017. I mean, yeah, they're losing Arden Key, but Arden Key was barely himself for most of the year. Their best defensive back, Greedy Williams, was a freshman. He's back. Their defensive line will be much improved from where it was. They just didn't have a ton of depth in a lot of key places. The area where I think they're in the biggest question mark is the running backs, because Darius Geis and Daryl Williams, who was a really good running back behind Geis, they're both gone. I don't know. You know, they signed two freshmen. We'll see what's going to happen there. I think they'll be fine at receiver. I know the people around the program are pretty confident in the young quarterback, especially Miles Brennan. But, you know, I don't know what's going to be in terms of, you know, Steve Ensminger. Orgeron liked what he did last season, you know, when he was the interim. But at the same time, I think he felt like he needed to make a splash hire on the offensive coordinator. That didn't work. And so he went with somebody he's comfortable with. And, you know, will that be enough? I don't know. I mean, I think that is if I'm an LSU fan, you know, I'm probably a little uneasy about it. You know, and I don't know who the offensive coordinator they would have liked to have seen him go get. I mean, if you had lost Dave Aranda, that would have been to me a much bigger concern. But at the same time, you know, we'll see, because Steve Ensminger has been an offensive coordinator a bunch of places. He's had some good results, and towards the end of his time as an offensive coordinator, not so good results. So the jury's clearly out.
I think that there's this perception of dysfunction at LSU going back to 2015, when Joe Oliva almost fired Les Miles but didn't, and then he came back and then he got fired after four games or five games, whatever it was. And so, I mean, Ed Orgeron, that was a whole lot of trouble he went through to go out, get Matt Canada, pay him a lot of money, go through the season. Now they have to reach this expensive settlement to get rid of him, only to end up back where they started with Ensminger. I mean, the fact of the matter is he did a really good job taking over that team when he did 2 years ago. Danny Etling as the quarterback. They were scoring a lot of points by the end of the year, and maybe he should have just stuck with him, and then this wouldn't seem so dysfunctional. But as it is, yeah, I could see why they would want a bigger name to come in there. I don't know. I'd say give it a chance, but I do get why people are skeptical.
Queasy.
All right, we have more questions in that we had pulled up, but after hearing your voice and your coughing and your sneezing, I am going to give you the rest of the night off. I think that's the merciful thing to do at this point. Send us your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we'll try to make up for it next week. We'll see you next time. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoy college football podcasts, also subscribe to The All-American Podcast with Nicole Auerbach, Max Olson, and Chantel Jennings. Our producer is Nick Fink. Our intro song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. Download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow Bruce on Twitter at BruceFeldmanCFB. Follow me, Stu, at SL Mandel, and subscribe to The All-American if you haven't done so already at theathletic.com/All-American. So come on, get over here. Yeah. We'll talk about it for years.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.